Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today we get to talk to Varun Raman and Tom Hancock. Varun and Tom made this amazing short film called Transmission. It was one of the top films at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2017. And the truth is, the only reason they haven't been on the podcast sooner is that Transmission has spent like well over a year on the festival circuit. I think a year and a half, even 2 years. It's just a brilliant visual masterpiece with an incredibly captivating story. So it's really no surprise to me to see a film like that just play all over the world. Tom and Varun have a great story of how they came together to become a great filmmaking team. But before you listen to this, you want to watch the film. Transmission is a film that everyone who has seen it has just absolutely loved it. So watch Transmission at discoverindiefilm.com. Then listen to this interview with the makers of Transmission, who sat down at a flat in Manchester, England, to talk to me over Skype so that you could hear how Transmission came to be. And for the record, the first voice you hear is going to be Tom's. Actually, the first voice you hear is going to be mine. But the first response is from Tom. Then you'll hear Varun. And at that point, you should be able to tell the two apart. All right, here's Varun and Tom. I really do think Transmission is one of the best films I've seen. And, you know, I see like hundreds and hundreds per year with two festivals. Yeah. We did try
to stupidly make a short film that people would want to watch again, because that was the number one problem with most short films. Because we've seen a lot of short films. We've programmed for some small things way back. And it's been a while since we've actually done that, but you're always looking at other short films to make short films, and you're always, you know, networking and all that, and seeing what people are raving about and seeing what people are winning where. I'm trying to put the picture together and see what it all means and why things win at certain places and why they don't. So we've seen a lot of short films, and Cinema 16, I don't know if you come across that. Cinema 16 distributed
short films, but they had collections of short films. Like, I think rather from going to festivals or looking for stuff on Vimeo, I think the Cinema 16 short films were definitely the best.
The number one in was, I think it's really good short films that's done the test of time, as well as like directors' early stuff. So people you will know, their early stuff that was worth watching, and also just really good ones. And that was some of the first Cinema 16. That's it. Some of the first short films we watched were absolutely amazing, absolutely beautiful. The thing about them, the medium, is that it can actually be, it's like poetry, it can be absolutely amazing, but there is so much of it made. But we thought, wow, what a medium. And it's, as we go along, it's probably harder than features.
Yeah, I think short films are best when they're at their most daring, and when they're willing to be very divisive and willing to piss off a few people, but then also please a few people a lot. I don't think you can make a short film really that pleases everybody.
You can't make any art that pleases everybody. But so you two watched a lot of short films, and intentionally, so before you even had the idea for Transmission, you kind of studied the medium and decided to approach it in that way?
I think it was more of a feeling of the kind of shorts that we have watched. Like, a lot of the shorts tend to try and cram in a three-act structure. They tend to be a proof of concept, like a teaser, like a scene from a bigger film. We wanted a short film to kind of just stand alone by itself in its own weirdness and be self-contained within that, and for you to be able to want to watch it again to kind of revel in the ambiguity of it. So you, when you want to watch it again, you'll reveal more layers to it. But when you're watching it, you are kind of guided by the feeling of it. It's better to feel something rather than just have something that's a bit
absolutely plotting. Well, before we get too much into it, tell me about your past. What path did you each take into filmmaking? Was it, were you friends first and then became filmmakers together? Were you two people who were interested in filmmaking who met and became collaborators?
Well, I guess we could start when we met. We both met at Manchester University in the UK, obviously. I'm a year ahead of Farron, so I was doing philosophy and politics, and he was doing physics in the year below. And we met at pretty much a party. A friend, his mate was my house. What's it called?
An old friend from school was living in Tom's house.
Turned out, and I just met Van, and he was an interesting person. So we kept in touch, and then we both wanted to do a radio show, and then we just both partnered up for that. And so that's the kind of the quick how we met. And then we did a radio show, and it was a little bit,
content for content's sake.
Yeah,
so it's trying to fill the silences, trying to
just shooting the shit between yourselves. You found your conversations. You were good conversationalists.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was conversation, but it wasn't an investigation. You know, there was no meaning at the end of it. There was no pulling on a rope or anything.
There was no reason for that show to exist.
Yeah. Right, there was no theme. There was no I understand, but it was probably entertaining.
It was it was more fun in the room probably than
I imagine it would be terrible listening to it now. Yeah. I don't think it would be.
We
good.
Always had a few friends just sat there just giggling, you know, it's stupid really, but fun. And anyway, so we were writing together a bit, and we realized we got on quite naturally. It didn't really feel like work, and then we decided I graduated a year earlier, so I was just kind of poking around seeing what was about in Manchester, and I found this course, and then I didn't get on, but the radio producer said, oh, you and your mate sound interesting, show me what you'd do if you could. And so we came back to him with a radio play thinking, how cool, radio is so cool, you can have enormous budgets. So we said, let's do a sci-fi. So we wrote a sci-fi,
this 19 sci-fi horror dialogue all over the place. I don't think it would be good to read now, but it was good to have that thing as the
but
best thing
we wrote it as a radio play.
Not knowing where it would be broadcast, so, you know, having the kind of newbie,
not having any connections in the radio world, we just kind of wrote it in.
But you wrote something with no visuals intended.
No visuals intended, you know, just, you know, spaceship sounds and just big radio sci-fi stuff, but with not the idea of where. You've got to know the marketplace. There's no point writing a 3-hour radio play if nobody puts 3-hour radio plays on. And there's no point putting a 90-minute one if you're totally unknown as well, and you have nothing much relevant and contemporary to say. But the main thing, the big, big main thing, was that somebody encouraged us to go away and write, and they said that they would read it and listen to it. And the guy loved it, but he got in somebody to read it over from actual drama, because he was in more kind of music documentary. He's a cool guy. And this lady came back and she said all these problems, and maybe it wasn't the best for a lot of reasons, but it made us realize, I don't know how we got to
think
film,
we wrote it for radio, but we did write it very visually. It was very sound design heavy. It was quite cinematic. We wanted the idea of being able to score it. So I don't think it fits into the, it didn't fit so well into the British radio play scene. I don't think they want that kind of stuff.
I love Radio 4. It's amazing. You just bash it and there's some random, fascinating mini documentary going on. It's so interesting. So I listen to a lot of radio. I've always got the radio. I can just plop it on. And sometimes it really just feels like radio is just often stuck in like kind of coconuts for horses. And it's almost like what they want as well. And so we just thought, let's abandon this world. And Byron... and I'll let you take him back into his history after this. Byron loves film from being very, very young, much more than me. And so he said, you know, I don't want to mess around with this. If we're going to do this, let's do film. So I'll take you to Byron's history now, if you like.
Excellent. Oh, well, I guess before I went to Manchester, I was the reason why I was a year below Tom at university is because I dropped out of university. I was at Imperial College London doing aeronautical engineering, and it was very boring and very unfulfilling. So I was just like, yeah, I definitely just want to drop out and be somewhere where it's a bit easier. There's more facilities. There's more interesting people to meet. So that's how I ended up in Manchester. But I've just been watching films a lot from the start.
Right, you were a cinephile growing up.
I guess I don't know about a cinephile. I watched a lot of films. I remember watching Terminator when I was 5, and that being quite an early experience, and just watching lots of violent movies whilst I was young.
So actually, action was your bag.
I don't know. I would think I was compelled to watching dark, violent, scary stuff from a young age. I don't know. I guess because my older sister tended to recommend these films to me, probably to scare me. And then I ended up watching a lot of this kind of stuff.
Right. And just being a lover of film, you watched just about all genres, or?
I kind of expanded more as I got older, but I would not say in today's standards that I'm a cinephile. I work at an art house cinema now, and then the amount of films that some of these people watch, like it's like a... Like
right, you weren't the type who names obscure films out of Paris in the 1940s.
I'm not like that. I'm no Quentin Tarantino. I can't tell you who was doing the costume design.
Me either. When people start naming European films and classic Hollywood, I'm like, well, my knowledge kind of starts in the 70s, maybe. It's a little 60s. Yeah.
It's far from an encyclopedic. I wouldn't say that. But I definitely grew up watching films and not reading books as much as, I guess, Tom did.
But neither of you grew up playing with video cameras.
No.
So
I tried. One of the first phone cameras that any of my friends had. My mates. I don't know what it was. I don't know what we were doing. I don't know. We were too young to be on. I think it was just all sugar. We were definitely on a high, but it was. I think it was just sugar. And I'm running around the house, and we had two Best of Queen CDs, and we were playing in different rooms, blasting. I can't remember which song it was. What was it? Don't Stop Me Now. And I'm not gonna go into what was happening, but we shot loads of shots to that. It was someone was getting chased, basically. It was pretty bizarre. And we had black pen chopped on mustaches, two of us anyway, running around the house. And I kept on bugging my friend to get off his phone. I don't know whether he lost it or decided to lose it. I kept on bugging him to edit it, but he just never did, and then he said he lost it. And so it was apart from that, though, and I think if we had put that film together, I think it would have made a lot more with my friends and messed around. But there was never the I don't know if I've ever even come across it that we have. What's that? Is it Austin where Linklater comes from? You know, there's cool cities that just have people just hang around making films, and it's adventure together.
We were out of step. Maybe we just didn't live in the right time for that to happen. And I don't think we have any romantic stories as the, you know, our father buying us a Super 8 camera and us learning how to make film with our toys.
You know, you don't need that story. I just, you know, your film is so visually accomplished that it just shows. Well, but before I get to how you made Transmission, we had your collaboration, so you met at university afterwards, a little bit of radio, and then Varen said, hey, let's do film.
So we do have a couple of shorts, you know, no budget. One of them in a living room, and another one in a few different bars. Just to, the first one's just purely visual, and we did a score afterwards.
A silent film,
about a minute and a half.
But that's when you start experimenting with film and video.
Yeah, so with every filmmaker and every... Just so many people. I hate saying the word artist, but you could probably say it even broader than that. With every person, they are not who you see. They are all their phantom projects, all the holidays they never went on, all their dreams, and you can't see all of them at once. There's so many things they could have made and got close to making, and we have had so many phantom projects, and it'd be fascinating if you could watch any of, say, you know, Tarantino again. He's not made many films, but I bet he's gotten very close on a lot of things. And it's a shame, but you don't see 70% of a person's output, but they feel like that. They feel like they're so full of ideas. And if you can only see this film, it's a bit like when you're the position we're in and now looking to the future, you know, when you have a meeting with somebody, and that's, there's just not enough words to, and they don't have the time.
I think we've written about 10, 12 shorts that have not been made.
Oh, it's like 20 shorts.
Maybe more than that, yeah.
And you wrote them all before transmission?
Yeah.
And they never got off the ground. We thought we could get funding, but then really, if it's not really possible in this country unless you know someone.
Nobody's going to fund transmission.
And especially, it becomes infinitely more difficult if you're a filmmaker that lives outside of London. It's just, it's about who you know, especially. Like, they all say that everywhere.
I'm not even sure it's about that. With the funding game, I just think...
Especially in Britain.
So the number one thing that people get out of government funds anyway, is they write applications and they fail. And that's good practice. That's great practice. You go into the budget, you go into locations, you see where all the problems are. You even get to the storyboard. We've even got to the storyboard on a few of them. And then you start to realize all your errors. You know, we used to write crazy, some of these short films are, sort of film scripts we've got are absolutely crazy. And if they were made, they would be one of my favorite short films.
They would have been out of absolute naivety in terms of numbers of locations, actors. But I guess looking back, I would still be like, yeah, that's very, very, very entertaining.
Yeah, but it's kind of stupid once you start looking into it. And that's what they're great for. They are fantastic for practicing, preparing. But it's such a shame that they exist so vividly in our heads, but they don't exist for anyone else to see.
Right, the ones that just weren't practical to shoot.
Yeah, expensive.
And then the ones that weren't ever going to get funding, because those, the kinds of things we were writing would never get funding.
Right, yeah, it's a dollar amount, or pound sterling, but it requires an amount of money that you can't raise yourself, nor can you get from any other sources.
Yeah, they're so expensive. They're so expensive. And with funds, I mean, it's a whole world and so many filmmakers are talking about it. But if you get one of these funds, it's not enough to... Because if you get official money and everything's on the book or in the book and signed off, and you have to pay people, there's no money.
It's still not enough.
There's no money for the camera.
Yeah. It's not enough to pay people, you know, what they are actually should be paid.
So if you want to do something particular, that normally means camera plot. And if you want to do something genre and a bit stylistic, it normally means camera plot. And camera plot normally means more than probably 15 shots in a day, definitely more than 10 or 12 shots in a day. And that's a long day, and that's some pretty talented crew you'll be getting in to make sure you're lighting wides and close-ups. It's not much money anyway, should you win those things. But, you know, you see some that are 20 grand, some that are 5 grand, some that are a grand.
Some that are hundreds of thousands, yeah, as well.
But the funny thing is that should you win any of them, the budgets might work out to be the same thing, depending on what they include in that cost and not. But it's good for one thing, and that is preparation, and that's the main job.
And getting better at writing, I think writing is probably the most underrated skill currently.
We always came into it as, oh, we lost the last fund. It just must mean that we need a crazier short film. And it just made them crazier and crazier and crazier. And
the process of applying for that kind of grant, or because here it's funny, because listening to you, I bet a lot of filmmakers here in the U.S. would be jealous, because we have almost no public funding of the arts.
That's probably a good thing.
It's a weird one, though, because I guess with us applying for funding, I don't know, it's like a goth trying to get into Catholic school. It's just never going to happen. It's never going to happen. Right. We don't offer the kind of thing, unless we got famous and then maybe we became a sure thing.
The funding chase is what made you keep writing script after script and honing your talents?
Yeah, in the hopes that we could actually make one of these films.
Well, it's good as well, because that's about 8 years of phantom projects. So you're building up your contacts, and you're building up a little bit of money as well that you never get to spend. And so that it's helpful in that way, because our one thing was that we didn't want to get sucked into the false economy of, we'll make one short film, but you make 5 short films. Like, we can do it. People do it, and it does work. But you make 5 short films, and one of them will be a success. But they're not really as cheap as you think they are. They're always about 3 times more expensive, but kind of secretly, and car parking fees and lunches and meetings and stuff like that. Or you can put it down and make sure it stands out. So we always just wanted to make sure when we took the leap, it would make a mark.
I think it's more exciting if you're doing a project and it feels beyond you a bit. It doesn't sound fun, really, if something seems like it sounds like it's going to be too easy.
If you know the answers already,
So as a project, you looked at Transmission after you wrote it and thought, okay, this one's going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
Definitely. I remember we're walking down the street and we finished the script, and I was thinking, and I knew we were going ahead with it. And I was thinking, just even looking at the script, it doesn't look like a script. It doesn't look like a proper film. Are we making a terrible... Is this our worst script that we're sinking everything into?
But we haven't even worked.
What's it about? I had to turn to Byron and say, Byron, what's it about?
But let alone worrying about what it's about. We haven't even worked with a proper cinematographer before, or an assistant director, or a focus puller, or a grip. None of these people, like these kind of members of crew, we'd worked with before. So we were having to just figure out how to work like that.
So what was your first step to go from script to screen? What was the turning point that got this one done?
We put our own money in.
Yeah.
That's the thing. We just said, we can't wait around anymore.
And we split the shoot into two. So we were just like, we just need the interiors for now. If we can get the interiors, we can worry about getting the exteriors at another point.
And we decided to put the limitation on, one room.
You say one room, but like I see a lot of films where the one room is someone's the living room of their flat, whereas your one room is just so cinematic. I mean, your cinematic instincts are so great, because you know that underground bunker elicits so much film history, really, in a way. I think it was a brilliant decision, even if it was just instinctive.
I think it was, so we, with all these phantom projects, we're thinking of, it did become a, what can we actually do? And it's annoying that we can't really mine all the other ones because they go all over the place. But 1984 was a very quick in because an interrogation. If you have something metaphysical, if you manage to make something metaphysical, you know, the non-physically existing, if you can get into that world, like dreams and memories, if you can find some kind of mechanism, you can do almost anything you want. It's really liberating. So an interrogation is perfect for that. It's very psychological. And if you get into the brain, you're free.
Yeah, we wanted to do a two-hander as well. So we were wanting to initially to make something very cheap. So we were like, just something that requires two actors, one location. But the thing that kept screaming to us was the most dramatic kind of two-hander you can have is an oppressor and the oppressed. And then it became an interrogation and an interrogator and a prisoner. And then it kind of blossomed from there. Every decision from that point kind of felt inevitable, and it just went in that direction.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a really enjoyable writing experience.
Or
is that just retroactive?
It was at first because we had some really strong set pieces that we thought. We came up basically with a lot of set pieces and then thought, how can we, these visuals should exist all together. This is a tone coming together. It's very much a tone piece. And then we kind of worked backwards as to how we could sew this together in kind of linear, because it's a very non-linear story. The only reason it seems linear to me is because it has to be at some point put together and extended in time, and the dimensions we exist in, you have to have that. But for me, it has happened, it is happening, and it will happen, and it's nightmares as well. It's complete kind of torment.
I'd say it's a film that is non-linear and linear.
I would debate you about the non-linear, because really if you piece it together in your mind, it is a linear story. It feels like you're all over the, you know, in different worlds, so to speak. But you can interpret it all and realize everything that's happening during his torture.
I like to feel that sometimes some of that stuff, something that it's necessarily present. You can't really work with an actor on that basis when you're shooting the scene. So
that's a useful thing about having a prisoner for who has been arguably tortured and held prisoner for God knows how long. If you put a film in their perspective, nothing is reliable anymore. You don't know whether we got from A to B just like that, or to C, or whether they're imagining things or remembering things. We're not entirely sure. That's the beauty of having an unreliable perspective.
Well, one thing that was good is that, so we were very sure about the tone. That's the main thing. I'm very, very sure about that. And that's what led us into going ahead with it. And we storyboarded every shot. Baron made an animatic, so the film exists as storyboards. And that was really good and kind of getting good crew involved and interested. And the fact that people kept on, good people that we respected, kept liking it and wanting to work with us on the basis of the materials we had was a good sign. And we still were unsure about it, but we kept going ahead and scouting and slowly going into it. But the day it all really kind of started to click was the first day of rehearsals and talking with the two lead actors. And we kind of went around and on the outskirts of what the topics were about, and slowly kind of spiraled in and in and in and in. And we started to realize that it made sense to them, and so many things they'd read, seen, watched, stories they'd heard, other plays they'd been in. And it did seem to it did have a center to it. But we just had to discover that center. But it was... very much a town piece, and just kind of just trusting that it might be interesting.
And I mean, just to back up a little, so when you decided, you know, you're going to take your own money and shoot this one, was that because you were just ready to do it, or also this script really shown to you too, that, you know, with the two locations, two people, was it a combination of many factors?
I think we were fed up of not making films.
Sure.
So we were like, we need to start a project and finish it. We need to see this through to the end. And I think our mindset before we'd even written the script was that we need this one to go
this
ahead.
This one, yeah, this one.
But another thing that we don't mention, what was really lucky, was we met the DP, director of photography, Thomas Shawcroft. When we met him a year or two in, whilst we moved to Bristol in 2012, and then we met him, I think, a year or 2 years later. And he basically, when we met him, he was saying how much we loved film, 35mm film, 60mm film. And then he was saying how comfortable he was with shooting film and how he wanted to do it and how he wanted to shoot a short on film. And it was kind of like the perfect collaboration for that. And it was kind of like a gift to have Tom to collaborate with.
And you could show him the storyboards you made, and he could see that you had a vision.
Yeah, and he was very good with collaborating on every process. And when we'd send him the boards and stuff, then he'd suggest a few shots here and there. And it was a very, very, very fortuitous collaboration. And,
He's absolutely amazing, and you know, maybe all DPs do, but the crew we brought on were top, and just kind of colour, the amount of tests he made us go through,
it's a real rigorous, he was the most rigorous type of cinematographer.
And you shot on film?
Yeah, we shot on 35mm film. We shot on Fuji Eterna Vivid stock. So the Fuji film factories, they closed down in 2013.
Yeah.
So we bought old stock and shot with that in January 2016. So yeah, this film doesn't exist anymore. I don't think you can
but
shoot
that,
anymore.
That film in particular picks up blues and greens really nicely. And I think it's, is it a lost, like, we really went for a Lost Highway kind of look. So we were trying to, and it always pops up as a reference for some reason. It shouldn't, but it does. But yeah, we kind of, it turns out, kind of went for a little bit of a look like that, which has led us down the path of more greens and blues in the production design as well. And Tom made us sit in the dark, the days in that basement, just trying different color palettes out as well.
But I think that's probably if you want to make a visual film with a very, very distinct tone and feel and look and aesthetic to it, I think you can't really escape that kind of process. That collaborative process is probably required to get something.
But film-wise,
probably.
Well.
I mean, your film looks, I guess that might be something you experience with that Cinema 16 and something, but your film visually is head and shoulders above other shorts. I mean, other shorts, I don't mean to say I've never seen a short as visually, just artistically accomplished as yours. But even just, the way you present the basement, you know, once you move from the TV to speakers, I mean, your choice of music is fantastic, too. But just, like, speaker, feet, I mean, you communicate so much, and it just looks, honestly, it looks like we're watching a feature film made by a major studio right off the bat.
Thank you. Yeah. It's so much... So yeah, just really have to say how amazing Tom Shawcroft was in the whole thing, because yeah, he looked at the boards. I tell you, when we looked down the viewfinder, it just looked like the boards. It was bizarre, and the production design as well. It's stunning, absolutely stunning. Everybody on that crew just just absolutely stunned me. It's like, it was like everybody, because we've never really, you know, we've never worked on a professional set, as you can guess pretty easily, just from only having one film. And it, when you get on a set and everybody's delivering far better than anything you imagined, it's such a relief. It's like they're all kind of, well, they are just, you know, directors of their own department. The actors are directors of their own department, of their own character. And we've done a lot of rehearsal work with them. And they just knew, I mean, Michael's got a lot of internal monologue.
So Michael plays Leonard.
Everybody just knew their job. And did their jobs so well. But again, if we can take any credit, it's meetings, testing, as many references as possible.
Right. You did your due diligence. You put in your time.
Well, we were terrified. That's the main thing. You know, you should go into it terrified. And that's the good thing about film as well. You go into it terrified and you will just over prep. Not with, don't want to do it with the actors too much, but yeah, over prep.
And if you meet a collaborator that is obsessive, I guess if for a director, if you meet a collaborator that's obsessive like Tom Shawcroft, you should go down that rabbit hole of obsession with them. You should go with them every step of the way to really figure out what the aesthetic of the film is going to be, what the film is going to be in general. I think people should embrace that.
Well, I have a hunch you guys are going to be too humble for this, but my assumption is if I spoke to Tom and the actors and other people, they would say, well, we so rarely see material this good, and we're so rarely working on, you know, something that we truly believe in, that I have a feeling that Transmission was something they all wanted to bring their best to, because it just showed so much promise, I'm sure.
I think James Hyland, who plays Dr. Sam, he's always very encouraging with us. It's very, very nice. And he was one of the, he's very vocal, and he, like I said, when we had the rehearsals and we were speaking with the actors, when you start to realize that it makes sense to someone who makes a living acting and is in good stuff and puts a good performance in whenever he's on screen, it gives you confidence.
It's hard to say though with the material that we're delivering. So when we're giving them a script, I personally don't know how good our scripts can necessarily come across when we hand them over, because that's only just a blueprint for what so many different processes that we have to go through to get to that film. Because I wouldn't be entirely sure if I got given the Transmission script that we'd see the film that we got at the end of it. It'd be confusing. It would be, elusive and not really very clear on the meaning. Like, I don't really, and you can't really gauge how good it will look. So it's in a weird way, I kind of think probably some of our scripts might seem hard to sell at first in terms of, you know, what you're going to get at the end, especially with that one.
But a lot of our Phantom projects and the ones we intend to make longer form, they're not that style. It's very strange. Again, like I was saying before about the kind of the Phantom identity that nobody sees. What they do see is quite strange, because that's really not very representative of you at all as well. You know, the person that you put out to people is a very small fraction, but then all they see is that.
It's an aspect of your personality. I guess that film can cover one side, one area that we can delve in. Like, if you really want us to go dark and metaphysical, we can go dark and metaphysical and surreal and very unforgiving in terms of the tone. But,
but then we've just written a really lowbrow comedy, really fast lowbrow comedy that's not particularly... it is nuanced, but it's not exactly, you know, slow and thought provoking. but you probably say that about a lot of filmmakers. I just wish they could get a lot more out about them. And sometimes it can get, because you are competing with your peers in a sense of your age group as you're all coming up, and you can get a bit jealous and say things here and there to, you know, people you know, but and say, oh well, I don't think that person is particularly ready, but they're being, you know, they're being held up by the institutions or something like that. But then that's not fair, because
they're doing something that we don't want to do anyway.
That's not the whole story. Yeah. You've not seen their best film. And their best conditions.
But, and they're doing their own thing as well.
You're always just going to want to do your own thing anyway.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, you can't be, you know, you can't be infinite. That would be impossible.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of filmmakers, we probably never get to see their best work because it's such a collaborative medium and requires so much financing behind it. It really is often a medium of compromise.
Mm. Yeah.
Definitely. But let me not talk about compromise. I was actually going to ask, because you brought up James Hyland, like, what was your casting process? Because one thing I noticed as I watch it, I mean, yeah, you only have 3 people in total on screen, but they're perfect.
Michael Sean, who plays Leonard, the prisoner, we met him on a course about 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago now. And it wasn't a very good course. It was one of those dream selling courses where you're on it for about 2 weeks, you pay a fee. But we met him, and we met another actor that we liked very much. And we made a short film with them, which isn't up online. And we, Michael's a friend basically, and we've always been wanting to write things for him. He's got very witty, expressive eyes, and he's got a presence when he's actually doing a take. He's definitely giving it his all, so we've always wanted to write stuff for him.
We first noticed him because he was in this room of it must have been about 50 filmmakers and 50 actors, and a lot of them are very young, so they hadn't really come into their, you know, that distinctive yet. But then we just kind of took a step back and said, let's just have a look around and just see who stands out. And Michael is just across the room. And he just soaks up a camera. His face is amazing. It's one of those faces that just like shadows up.
He just said, who's that guy? Thoughts. Who's that guy?
Yeah, who's that guy? Let's talk to him. He's just really dedicated. He's one of those actors that is a proper soldier. You could make them do anything. You know, they would do anything for the character and for the shot. And he did lots of pain as well in that, because, you know, he's kind of hanging for a bit, lots of pain,
but he's very patient and very dedicated. But with James Hyland, who plays Dr. Sam, we went to a music video event in Manchester again about probably about 7-8 years ago, and one of the directors on this music video event, who stood out more than any of them in terms of his videos, he made surreal funny stuff, and the director was Ian Ponsjewel, and he made a video for Tiny Temper and Jargon. It's called Disappoint You, and James Hyland is in that video, and he plays a policeman, just a really horrible policeman that accidentally spikes himself with some drugs and then just goes on this hallucinatory trip.
The video has a prologue, it has a lot of, because so Ian's doing incredibly well. So Ian Ponsjewel is an associate producer on the film, because we asked him so many questions so many times that he got back so quickly and helped us very fast and connected us. Really, really, not only good guy, he's probably even better as a filmmaker. He's making great adverts and stuff now. But so we said to Ian, because we got in contact, got a dialogue going, and we met up and we got on really, really well. And we said to him, oh, you write well as well. It was the prologue to Disappoint You is really really good. How did you do that? And he said that James just turned up with it, kind of made it on the spot. And James writes, produces his own stuff, does a lot of theatre. But he puts it all on his back and he writes a lot. He just really knows his stuff. he looks so, again, he looks so good on screen. And that's very important to us. But he, those guys, their faces should be on enormous screens more often, I think.
They should be, as well as your Joan, too. When she appears, actually, as you said that, I said to myself, you know what? Your actors are a production value, because watching your film, they really are movie star types.
Yeah, so Kelby Keenan.
We cast her last, and I think we basically became our own casting directors. We were just looking at every possible agency in Britain and just looking at faces. I guess what kind of feeling do you get from a face, and what kind of character type?
Because she's got to be a little bit cherubic, you know, little bit angelic, but at the same time, a tiny bit of distance, and not entirely trustworthy, because I think that's one of the most ambiguous parts of the film, is how real she is, who she is, whether she's there or whether she is, whether Dr. Sam has manipulated the memories. So it's a very small, you know,
she was the only thing.
Yeah, and she hands him the pen, right?
Yeah.
So that is an act of deception of sorts.
Yes.
But still, she does look angelic, and she looks like the kind of woman that he might have joined the resistance for.
So there is over preparation. We have this 50 questions document, which we tend to try and not go easy on ourselves and get about 45-50 pages out on each character. And so we give that to the actor before, and it helps us go back over a treatment and colour it in with character details. And it helps kind of program an actor as to, in the past, how they might react in current situations. And if they think it's all truthful, if they don't entirely disagree with us and the fact that we've given them something like that, then they have a reference always onto how to act. So they do have a big backstory, quite a long backstory.
So Kelby had a big backstory that was very much entwined with Leonard's backstory as well, with Michael's backstory in the film.
I have to ask, you said 45 to 50 pages per character?
Because
it's funny, I sometimes advise people, screenwriters come to me for help, and over the years I've always begged them, write 5 to 10 pages of this character's biography so that you know it. Because so many writers, all they have is a name and maybe an age. And I'm like, if you don't know who these people are, you're just going to write a stereotype. You're not going to write a person. So the fact that you guys have five to 10 times what the average lazy screenwriter even refuses to do, that tells me something.
Well, we actually didn't do that haven't yet done that on a feature we've just written.
It depends on the demands of the project.
What, that it was just three characters?
Not just three characters. I guess because some of these performances, one of them is literally silent. I think we thought it would be good to load them. And I guess the tone of the project demanded people to really understand their characters. Like, I guess if something's a bit more frivolous and a bit more of a, I don't know, we just happen to have not done that on the feature script that we've just written.
Right. Well, it sounds like the one that's more of a comedy.
Yeah, because the other one's the feature script we've just written is more based on the concept and what the ultimate concept is saying and what the plot is actually saying about our current situation.
But with Michael, the Leonard character, we needed him to have an internal monologue. He needed to have a response and a word and a thought for everything, and we didn't want to tell him exactly what that would be each time. So we wanted him to have a life inside his brain that he could go to, and he could get his own answers out of it. And then with Dr. Sam, we did a few workshops with them, all three of them actually. And I wish we'd recorded them, but maybe you can't really fully capture it. They were amazing.
Yeah, that's the best way to actually help. On top of the questionnaires, to help devise a character is to do workshops, to rehearse with them and allow them to create scenarios in their past. You know, it's so that they've both actors have created a shared past between characters. That's a very interesting and I think it's probably quite a liberating way for actors to build a character up, because then they're changing things as well. Even things that we'd initially put in the questionnaire, or they were challenges on that. And if the workshops, if it turned out a bit differently, because it felt natural to them, we would say we'd go this way with the character. This is what their history is instead of what we wrote in the first place.
Yeah. But what it's a really good way of doing is prepping them, hugely prepping them. But there's nothing about the film in there. So you can't over-prep them in terms of when you get to the film and when you get to the workshops. When you get to the workshops, again, you don't have to use things from the film. So we did scenarios before
the events of the film.
Yeah. And again, it leaves you really, really fresh, and they're not using anything up. They don't have to save anything or hold back in the workshops.
It sounds like an extremely creative process.
Very, very
it's
cool.
It's very fun. We'd love to do that. I think it would be great if you could get that liberty.
It's so worth it, because even when you write to that person, even when you write with a particular actor in mind, it's amazing how far off they can be in the first, when you first try it properly.
If they're not given that, I guess, that care or attention to detail, or given the space to and be enveloped by the character.
It's like the marble statue thing. You need to chip. Even though you think, because you've imagined it in your head and you know how good they are, but they were better than, you know, they were better than even imagined. But when you first working with them, it's not as good as you imagined, and you just think, we have to work to get there. And then by the time you get on set, it's better than you imagined, which is fantastic.
That's because you put in the work. I have to ask, with this much background material, is there no temptation in the two of you to expand this to a feature someday and really give this world of Britannia, where, you know, it's this morning when I watched it for the, like I joke, 17th time, but I really have watched it many times, and anytime I start it, I have to finish it, which is a super high compliment. But I actually paused it on the sheet that Dr. Sam holds, so I could. That was the first time I got to just read all of his crimes and what they wanted to confess to, and that level of detail you included. I mean, there is obviously you did world building. You created a whole universe where. Could be the future, could be another time and place, but there is a Britannia that is a 1984 style dictatorship of sorts.
Yeah, it would be. There's probably always a time for that as well. Probably especially now.
We've done an outline, like years ago after the radio play, we outlined three parts, I think, three different films, like a trilogy.
Yeah, it's really, really rough outlines. So
But in my heart, I can hope for the day that you guys actually get to the point that you make your Britannia trilogy. And this was in transmission is the tiny kernel of it.
Yeah.
This would be a tiny bit probably later on in the story.
It's probably, the thing is that you'd want it to be a kind of a trilogy, a big sci-fi trilogy, where this is maybe a bit in the second one, maybe, and Dr. Sam wouldn't even be the main bad guy kind of thing.
Right, no, this is just one of the good guys got caught, and this is one little moment.
Yeah.
One guy's death, one good guy's death.
Yeah.
It's
a cool, cool world, actually. We have got quite...
I'm actually remembering it, and
now you've got me want to do my thing where I joke I want to light a candle to your potential project, and now I got to light a candle for a trilogy, a sci-fi trilogy. Boy, a dystopic.
That would be very nice. It might just help it come alive.
You never know.
Better tonight when I sleep. I'll know if you do it or not.
Yeah.
I might just. I'll do it. I'll do it. I mean, I'm.
Invited to everyone. Everyone's.
If someone wants to give us some money, if they're listening for it, yeah, we'll happily accept it.
I need to learn on many, many more things before that stage. Well,
so I mean, obviously, you've been in. I've watched. You submitted to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, and I'll tell you something, a little extra information later, but, you know, we were proud to show it, and then, we friended each other on Facebook so that, to create a Facebook event for your screening, and then I've been able to watch Transmission for well over a year run on the festival circuit. I mean, how long have you been on the festival circuit with this?
Probably, it must be about
a year and a half now.
Yeah.
And just countless festivals?
I think it was worth it. There's some people say, no, there's a new model now of get your international premiere and then 3 months after you've got a good brand name behind you, release it online and get it everywhere. That seems to work, and people get into bigger festivals after they do that, which is crazy, but that seems to happen. But we wanted to, a bit like a kind of sonar, let it go and see what bounced back and hopefully find cool people.
I mean, I think you did it the right way, and I would assume that everyone who sees it, the more festivals it plays, the more people who will see it. And it's so memorable. I mean, I'm sure I'm actually friends with some of the people... friends now with the filmmakers who your film played with. And it's funny, I'd love to send you links so you could see who you played with, because it was a really strong block. And, you know, if I mention Transmission to them, they, you know, a year later, they still know exactly what I'm talking about. I don't have to go deep into, you know, the one with the guy. And he's hanging in the beginning, but then he's having dinner, but then he's not, then he's outside. You know, I don't have to go into any of that. Like, your film is completely memorable. So if you've played 30, 40 festivals in the last year and a half, that's just, you know, hundreds, even thousands of people remembering this piece of work.
Yeah, well, I think the main thing is that we wanted to just play all over the world, really. And the cooler the cinema, the better. The cooler the crowd. We don't really know what's out there. I mean, we didn't submit to every single film festival.
But, no, there's only like 2,000 in the...
Yeah, oh my God. Really did a lot of the work on finding a lot of the cool places, because the ones that might accept it. I mean, Sherman Oaks, like we said in the emails, again, Varun was the one who found out that it was like quite a cool part of town with a lot of film people working there. Quite a few festivals we've applied to because they've got a lot of film people working nearby, and we thought those people will surely because again, when we were shooting on set, we had a lot of people well overqualified for being on our set. But they were up for it, and they seemed to enjoy it, just because we got to try out a few different shots than you normally get to do, in your normal shooting on set, back and forth shots and things. So visually, we wanted to kind of interest as many people as we could and just see who was out there that would like something like this.
Yeah, and actually, I'll send you the link, but if you go to the Discover Indie Film website, there's the film that showed before yours is called The Faceless Man, and I believe it's embedded on the website if you want to check it out. But the lead actor of that is a very well-known TV actor, and he actually has an acting school here in Los Angeles. So the audience was full for your screening with actors, with aspiring actors. So, you know, it was they loved it.
Yeah, I really want to. Well, we really want to check out your website as well. It's getting harder and harder, because normally, like I said, we prep as much for everything as possible. But even with meetings with people as well, and so much going on, you know, like a lot of filmmakers don't get to watch many films anymore. It's so hard to actually keep up with your day-to-day life after a while.
Oh, believe me, as someone trying to do podcast interviews and program film festivals, and I just had a major milestone birthday that I was stupid enough to throw a big party for that I had to plan. It's, I don't expect you to check everything out on the website. I'm just going to send you the link after we're off the line so that you can check out this one film, because it's cool like yours, not at all like yours, but it's equally visual and original. And just then you'll see that actor and go, oh, that guy, he brought his whole classroom to watch our film.
Nice. Well, if anyone wants to work with Kelby out there, she's in Los Angeles, I think, now. I think she's over there.
Oh, excellent.
She's getting back as well, yeah.
Yeah.
So I normally always ask, so what's going on next for you? So are you guys actively pitching this feature you've just written, or...
We've also written a pilot and a series bible that we've written for some producers that are about, I think they're going to approach US production companies to partner with them potentially. So there's that on the back burner. But yeah, with this feature script, we definitely want to direct it, and we're just about to start pushing it hard to, approach people.
Yeah, and I mean, have you, I mean, I know I'm fishing for it, but I mean, have you're mentioning meetings and things, so has Transmission been a great calling card for you?
Yeah. What we didn't realize was that we thought we had to make some more shorts. You get into that mindset after a number of years doing it. But we've just been meeting people lately, and thanks to the run and from competitions we've won, we've got to speak to good mentors. And to have working industry people say that they didn't think we needed another short really freed us up about 2 or 3 months ago, just to focus on features now. We both believe in the if you build it, they will come. So if you build a feature, then hopefully we'll build a feature. Might as well just start doing that.
As always, Tom and Varen are those filmmakers who couldn't travel overseas to come to the film festival when we showed their film, but talking to them after the fact, I wish they could have, man. They are very cool guys. Well, I certainly hope you've watched and enjoyed Transmission. This is one of those podcasts that goes up the same moment that the film is released online. So if you want a link to where you can see it, just go to discoverindiefilm.com and look at the podcast that has Transmission in it. And to wrap up this business, we just finished the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. It was a great 3-day event all weekend, had great crowds and great films. Have to say, I'm glad to have a little time to relax right now and get back to some podcasts. But Film Invasion LA is going to come up next June, and we're already accepting films for it. So go to filminvasionla.com to find out more. And who knows when you're listening to this? The Sherman Oaks Film Festival is every November, so maybe you should go to shermanoaksff.com to find out about that. Or shermanoaksfilmfestival.com, but that's so much longer you can get a typo in it. I know I do. Alright, that's a lot of .coms, but filminvasionla.com, discoveringdfilm.com, shermanoaksff.com, those are your .coms for the day. Thanks for listening. Yeah.